to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm back in Libertyville, Illinois. I need to stop saying that at some point because I'm here every week now. We're not on the road. It's a good episode, and we have another episode of Van Til Group lined up for you today, and that means we have with us Reverend Dr. Carlton Wind, associate pastor, if I'm not mistaken. He's stepped it up from assistant land. He's associate pastor at Westminster PCA in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Carlton, good to see you today.
Hey, great to be with you guys. I'm not trying to climb any ladders. It's just trying to be faithful. It's great to see you guys. So glad we could be doing another Van Til Group. Glad to see that everybody's wearing the same clothes we had on for Van Til Group number 10.
A month ago. We've been here for an entire month and haven't changed our clothes. There you see on camera as well, Dr. Lane Tipton, our fellow of biblical and systematic theology and a pastor at Trinity OPC in Easton, PA. Welcome back, Lane. Good to see you at the Van Til desk once again at the helm.
It is great to be here. I am an associated pastor associated with the OPC.
So. Yeah. But not ARP, the Associate Reform, but a different type of association. Well, it's great to have everyone here today. Again, we're continuing on our conversation of Van Til's classic book, The Defense of the Faith. I've got a hardcover first edition here, and we're working through, and the pagination we use is referring to these page numbers. If you have an electronic Logos edition, it should be the same. But otherwise, you can figure out where we are because we're usually trying to work off of page numbers as well. Today, we're going to be turning on over to page 63, if I'm not mistaken. Let me get my notes. Yes, 63 through page 67, talking about sin and its curse. So last time, we spoke about man's knowledge of the world universe, and we spoke about God being the ultimate context and environment for man's knowledge. The man can have true knowledge indeed, but never comprehensive knowledge, because only God has comprehensive knowledge, and all knowledge in the entire world and universe is all related to and dependent upon the incomprehensible God to begin with. So therefore, our knowledge is dependent on our existence is dependent upon God as well, and our knowledge needs to follow suit, to use a card analogy. I'm going to say it's euchre. That's my favorite suit Trump-based card game, not Donald Trump. But I don't have his NFTs yet. You guys seen these? You guys got to get some of these NFTs, Trump NFTs. They look great. And then we'll issue our own.
Is Reform Forum endorsing any presidential candidates?
Are you running? We don't do that sort of thing. We have a hard enough time mentioning anything in current events for good reason. But we're definitely not on the cutting edge like some neo-Kyperians in the transformationalist sense. And they're not all that way, but... very different approach here, but we are very much thankful for the work of Cornelius Van Til and the way that it does apply to current events and current issues in culture. We had one brief application last time in the last Van Til group, speaking about objective and subjective reality, and do objects exist outside of our world, or outside of our mind, I should say. And or do objects conform to our minds? And we didn't spell it all the way out, but we're living in a world in which people are functioning as if the external world does conform to our own minds and wills entirely. So, think about the transgender issue that we're dealing with right now, where there's a total rejection of biology as some sort of static given thing. And we could just bring our own categories to the world, impose them upon external reality, external phenomena, and force it to be something other than what it is in itself, or more specifically, what it's been defined to be by God himself. And so there are implications for these philosophies. So as we're dealing with the defense of the faith, and as Van Til's getting into some things which to many people might seem, a little bit ivory tower-ish, they're not. I mean, we're talking about everyday experience. We're talking about how the world is and how we live and move and have our being in our God, and how that comes to bear upon the most basic things. Just how do we know? How do I know I'm here? Not imagining this. How do I know these two people at the other end of Zoom exist? Maybe they don't. Maybe ChatGPT has created them, and I'm just having a conversation with some robots. But I have good reason to believe that they do exist. I have two brothers created in the image of God like me and talking about these important things. So, Carlton, I'm going to turn things over to you. We're talking part five here of on your notes, page 63, looking at sin and its curse. Why is it important for us to consider sin? We've already set, and you may want to review a little bit yourself, but we've already set the stage for man's knowledge of the world. We absolutely must talk about sin and its curse and the effects of sin upon that knowledge. Why is that so critical?
Yeah, thanks, Camden. You did a great job setting everything up in terms of where we are in the book. Maybe I'll just make a quick reference to the fact that back in chapter 2, when Van Til talked about a Christian philosophy of reality, he closed it with a section titled Sin and Its Curse. But he really didn't go into a lot of depth in that section. He mainly just posited that Christ, through redemption, brings creation to its originally intended eschatological fruition. It's a remedial and redemptive rescue and an advance of all that God has made. But here in chapter 3, when he talks about man's knowledge, a Christian philosophy of knowledge, and specifically man's knowledge of God and the world, it's eminently appropriate to talk about sin and its curse, because in the realm of epistemology, the impact of sin is felt quite keenly. And the subject matter that Van Til has been addressing, namely man's knowledge of God and how that knowledge bears on man's knowledge of everything around him, including himself, is just prime for a discussion on the way sin affects human knowledge. And so it's important because, as we didn't plan this, but as we're talking about presidential politics or sexual revolution, we can't escape the reality of sin and its effect on what we claim to know, what we claim to be true and real. So he says we must take sin into account. And the first thing that Van Til says on page 63 is he clarifies what sin doesn't do. But it doesn't do. And it's almost as important to say what sin doesn't do as to say what sin does do. So what does sin not do? Page 63. He says, by sin, we do not cut ourselves loose from God metaphysically. Whatever else sin does, it does not render us other than or less than God's creature. It does not disrupt the fact that we are metaphysically the image of God. It does not sever us from the lordship and exhaustive interpretation of God. It does not absolve the religious relation that we have to God as his image. What it does do is it turns that religious relation in an ethically wicked direction, and it characterizes that relation according to guilt and corruption and manifested in rebellion. This is the way he puts it on 63. Sin is therefore a breaking loose from God ethically and not metaphysically. Sin is the creature's enmity and rebellion against God, but is not an escape from creaturehood. To put it very practically, you know, when we're born as sinners, when we grow as sinners, we still have a mouth metaphysically, but we say things that are sinful. We speak things that are not true of God. We deny him with our lips, right? The poison of asps is on our lips. We have ears. We can still hear. But because our heart is turned against God, we close our ears to a spiritual understanding of the word. We make our hearts diamond hard, as the prophet says. We cast his law behind our backs. And yet in all of this, as Paul says in Romans 1, we know God. We know his righteousness. We know his goodness. We know his kindness to us. And yet that kindness does not lead us to repentance, but it actually hardens our heart. What does sin involve? Van Til says on page 63, it involves every aspect of man's personality. It involves our will, which has become stubborn. It has become, it involves our intellect, which has been darkened in sin due to our hardness of heart, Ephesians 4 says. It involves, we could add, our emotions. You know, we don't respond as emotional beings the way that we should, either to God or to the world or in relationships that we have. All of these things are the ethical and practical outworking of sin. Even as metaphysically, we live and have our being, live and move and have our being before the face of God. And we encounter his self-revelation everywhere we go, including when we look at ourselves. So let me turn it over to Lane. Lane, given the fact that we're not cut loose metaphysically, but we are turned against God ethically, how does this bear on man's interpretation and knowledge of the world? How does Van Til characterize the effects of sin on man's knowledge of his environment?
Well, what's so fascinating about that presentation of Van Til, which you did an excellent job of summarizing, brother, and I think this needs to be hit home. This wonderful biblical summary you gave is the Augustinian and Reformed teaching concerning original sin. This is not the teaching of the traditional Roman Catholic Church. This is not the teaching of post-Reformation Lutheranism. This is not the teaching of Arminianism. It's most certainly not the teaching of Socinianism. I think when we recognize this, here's what we have to say first about man's knowledge of God, man's knowledge of the world and sin. There are a couple of excellent summaries of this in Westminster Confession 6:4 and 9:3. Listen to how strong this language is. Van Til often faces criticism because he speaks so strongly about sin and its noetic effects. But listen to this. From this original corruption, whereby we are utterly disposed, disabled, and made opposite to all good and wholly inclined to all evil, do precede all actual transgressions. Or listen to Westminster 9:3. Man, by his fall into a state of sin, has wholly lost all ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation, so as a natural man, being altogether averse from that good and dead in sin, is not able by his own strength to convert himself or to prepare himself thereunto. Now, if this is true, as you said, Carlton, of man as the image of God, if this is true of man in terms of his emotional, volitional, and intellectual propensions, then what Van Til's saying is that sin is not simply a loss of superadded gifts, is not a weakening of the good. It is a fundamental baseline blinding corruption. And Van Til says this, just to take the first step toward an answer to your question. Van Til says that when sin entered the world, and he starts to say this around page 64, and I'm not going to give a quote yet, I just want to frame it. The prerogative that a sinner assumes to himself is this, here it is, that if God happens to exist, who he is, what he demands, and how I relate to him will be settled by terms that I establish in my autonomy. And lurking right underneath that neutral, autonomous relation to God, that purported relation of neutrality and autonomy, Van Til says lurks a heart that is hostile to God. And so, as Van Til does, if you take it back into the Garden of Eden and you look at the time point of Adam's sin, Adam goes from joyfully receiving God's self-revelation and interpreting himself and the world, his image-bearing identity and his role as a priest and king in the Garden of Eden under God's authority, he goes from joyfully embracing all that God has revealed to himself in nature and in covenant to being instantly one who, by his sin, has assumed the prerogatives of deity or at least co-deity to himself. That whatever God says must be tested. Whatever God says has to be validated by the authority of reason. And sin, therefore, and there's going to be more to say, but not less. Sin brings about a baseline relation to God where the creature has either ultimate legislative authority or conjoint legislative authority on par with God. And this is kind of a profound thing that Van Til's saying, but he's saying that sin introduces a kind of sin presupposes a mutualized relation to God where his interpretation must be taken as a hypothesis to be tested by man's rational capacity. Quite insightful.
Yeah, Lane, that's a devastating explanation of what Van Til's getting at here. So let me just reaffirm what you've just said by picking up one little thread. You said that sin's effect is comprehensive and does not consist merely in the loss of some superadded gift, or we could phrase it, it doesn't merely consist in the veiling or corruption or loss of a spiritual compartment of man's existence, while leaving a so-called natural or immanent or, you know, ordinary rational realm relatively untouched. But if we can remember what Van Til has said about God's exhaustive knowledge of self and the world, his exhaustive decree, and the pre-interpretation of all that he has made, and the necessity of bringing every object of knowledge, here I'm dovetailing on what we talked about last time, every object of knowledge must be brought into relation, or rather our knowledge of God must be brought into relation to every object that we think about or discuss in this world. Sin, rebellion against God, hostility against God necessarily affects our interpretation of literally everything in the cosmos. So that there is no realm of this created world in which sin has not destroyed a true understanding of the world because of our hostility against the God who owns and pre-interprets the world.
Right. Sin is no respecter of realms. It's right. A totalizing, invasive, and permeating reality. And I think Van Til sees that as clearly as anyone in the 20th century, Carlton. And I think one reason he sees it so clearly is he keeps going back to the Garden of Eden, as we will be talking about, to compare and contrast sinless Adam and his receptive reinterpretation of God's revelation with rebellious Adam, who instead of being receptively reconstructive, wants to be creatively constructive, and not in a neutral way, in a way that displaces and replaces God's interpretation, God's revelation, with his own interpretation.
Yeah.
And with his own set of presuppositions about what is ultimately real, what is ultimately good, what is ultimately knowable.
I just wanted to make that point because when you read from Westminster Confession 9:3 that man by his fall has wholly lost all ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation, there might be some out there who say, okay, but that's spiritual good.
Yeah.
Man retains an ability to will natural good. you know, as though this is a separate compartment. But if we really get the depth of God's lordship over all of life, the implications of our knowledge of God for knowledge of anything else in the world, you know, the comprehensive character of man's religious relation to God, we can't make that kind of distinction. We have to say, no, sin has affected our interpretation of all things.
Absolutely. And that's why I think 6:4 is so good to supplement that. We are utterly disposed.
Disabled, I think the word is indisposed. Yeah.
Pardon me. Utterly indisposed.
Right.
Disabled and made opposite to all good. That's the money quote, right, Carlton?
Yep. That's it.
Yeah. To all good and wholly inclined to all evil.
Yeah.
Therein lies the fact that it's both spiritual and natural. It's, in other words, as you just said it, it's comprehensive enmity against God that we're speaking of.
Yeah. I like the canons of Dort on this because they say even in things natural and civil.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, which is a helpful, you know, closes that loophole there. Well, as we think about the comprehensive effects of sin on man and his interpretation of all things in the world, Van Til makes a fascinating point, and you touched on it earlier, Lane, when you talked about everything related to God needing to be subjected to man's autonomous or rational assessment. But much religious language and much religious belief can abide that prerequisite, right? Yes. That everything, like, it doesn't mean that the sinner is just an overt atheist, but the sinner can say and will want to say much about God, much about religiosity, much about the Christian faith, but at every point, what the fallen sinner cannot abide, and this Van Til makes very clear, I think on page 63, is that God is self-sufficient and self-complete. That is something that for all the talk about God, right? If so long as God is not self-sufficient and self-complete, here's the way we put it positively, the sinner can be very pleased. The fallen sinner can be very happy going about his religious life, so long as God is not absolute. But the moment you introduce an absolute God, game changer. Game changer, hostility provoked, and sin rearing its head. So what does this mean? What does this mean practically? He goes on to say, at best, if God is not self-sufficient or self-complete, and yet God language is still invoked, God and man are correlative with one another. Lane, for the 500th time, Give us a definition of what it means for God and man to be correlative.
The simplest and most basic way is that both us are submerged in a process of mutual change. God changes in his relation to man. Man changes in his relation to God. And they are interdependent in that unfolding relation. And Carlton, you know, as you think about this, and Camden, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Van Til says that that what happens in the Garden of Eden, in effect, was that God's self-sufficiency and self-completeness are denied by Adam. And there's a sense in which, I'd like to say this, I don't want to go beyond Van Til, but let's assume, for the sake of argument, that God is correlative to the universe. Let's assume further, like many evangelical biblicist mutualists do even today, that God doesn't know the future. He doesn't know whether Abraham believes in him. He doesn't know where Adam and Eve might be in the garden. He's just ignorant and developing like the creature, maybe on a larger scale, but developing. Here's the thing I think Van Til's getting at. If you believe in a correlative God, and he says the day that you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die. What is that? At very best, it's a hypothesis that needs to be tested. Because God cannot, on mutualist terms, if he has a developmental, ignorant, covenantal mind, he has no idea whether that's actually true. He can surmise it's true. He can project it's true. He might have a fairly sophisticated algorithm that it's likely true, but he doesn't have exhaustive, definite foreknowledge. And just because of that, Adam could reason as a fallen creature, well, God, let me help you in your developmental understanding. Let's see. I'll eat of the tree, and we will test the hypothesis as to whether or not I will die. And from one vantage point, that's consistent with a God who doesn't know the future. And in that sense, the reasoning would be quite perverse. There's a sense in which, as Van Til says, God needs man and man needs God as they grow together in their understanding of the facts that are yet to come in, as they're open to the developmental mystery of the universe. Both are ignorant and developing. And I think Van Til's basically saying this, that if you don't have a self-contained, self-complete, omniscient, immutable triune God speaking, you're absolutely free to treat anything he says as a hypothesis, because it would be. There is no definite, certain, and infallible foreknowledge, free knowledge. Nothing has been determined infallibly and immutably by God. And Van Til's then getting at the fact that whenever sin is introduced, that tacit assumption is always present in the heart, in the mind, in the thinking, in the presuppositional substructure of the sinner.
I think you're tapping into the nature of the temptation in the garden as well, because essentially what the serpent was tempting Adam and Eve to do was to treat God's self-interpreting absolute word concerning the tree as a hypothesis. Okay. And he was saying, try it out. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. God may know more than you know, but he doesn't know without you.
Yes.
And he is learning with you what will happen if you actually do eat of the fruit. So even before the teeth went into the fruit, Adam and Eve had to presuppose that God knew, at least was on par with Satan's suggestion.
That's right.
That the outcome of that act would not be as God said, certainly.
Which entails that Satan himself is the primal mutualist, and that Adam and Eve's mutualism is a kind of derived conformity to Satan's mutualism, because it's Satan who put forth the unthinkable proposal that God would be limited in his knowledge in such a way that perhaps his word isn't true. In fact, he directly contradicts it, thereby implying God neither knows nor controls whatsoever comes to pass.
Do you think here we're getting a little I hope not off course, but do you think that Satan as a self-conscious creature necessarily presupposes a mutualist account of God's relation to the world as a presupposition for his own rebellion and pursuit of an apostate throne?
Brother, that's such a good question. I'm going to default to my early training right here. I read Greg Bahnsen's dissertation that in 1995, a portion of which was published in the WTJ under the title something like The Apologetical Implications of Self-Deception. And I think that this is the case in all instances of self-deception. I think that in the depth dimension of his being, Satan knows that God is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable, and his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. And that is what propelled his original sin of covetousness. But I think that he is so entirely sinful, so utterly depraved that at the same time that he knows that, of all creatures, he's the most strongly self-deceived in thinking he can win, thinking God is limited, that there has to be some plan. Because if Satan does, at least in terms of his espoused worldview to Adam and Eve, the degree to which he believes it is set within this context of the self-deception. But to the extent that he sends the beast with wrath, it seems to be on the faulty, self-deceived assumption or presupposition that perhaps God is, as mutualists say, limited in power, limited in knowledge, limited in space, and can, therefore, if the plan is well done enough, be overtaken. So I would say probably he's like an archetype of an unbeliever who both knows the living and true God, yet, I mean, seamlessly and in an utter dipolarity within his being suppresses it and operates out of that side of wicked, blasphemous rejection of God's absoluteness.
Yeah. Thinking about, yeah, that's helpful. Thinking about, this is just a solemn topic to consider, and we have to keep our eye on our own hearts as we do it. Just recognizing the implications of sin, but just a little window into my world. I'm preaching this coming Sunday on John 13, verses 21 to 30, and it's Judas's betrayal. And just listening to Van Til talk about how much religious language can abide some kind of transcendent deity, but so long as he's not self-sufficient and absolute, it just seemed to dovetail with John 13, how when Jesus says, one of you will betray me, like all the disciples are looking at one another and they don't know who it is. And It just, one of the points that I hope to make is how deceptive sin really is. You know, even in Judas's own heart, he was there benefiting from all kinds of acts of mercy and love, and even receiving the morsel of bread from the hand of Christ, possibly even reclining next to him on his left side at the table. And with that final act of love and generosity, his heart was hardened, and until finally Christ said, what you have to do, do quickly. And essentially handing him over. But it's a healthy reminder to us to remember the deception of sin. It really is.
It is. And to remember the wonder and glory of God's grace is that through the regenerating power of the Spirit working through the gospel, we're given eyes to see truly, not just God, not just the world, but ourselves and our great need for the grace that is in Jesus Christ as he liberates our wills, inflames our affections, and renews our mind in the delight of communion with himself. So this really is, Carlton, I'm glad you're bringing this up. I was thinking of a way to try to work it in. You did it much better than I would have. This really is, whenever you talk about the doctrine of sin, it really is a sobering thing for us to remember. We're not playing philosophy games. We're not doing Wittgensteinian language games. We're not trying to gain a following. We're not trying to sound erudite. We're not trying to impress people. We are people. We are men who know ourselves as sinners, who know ourselves as self-deceived in Adam, who know ourselves to be liberated by the sheer free grace of God, the sovereign grace of God that is in Jesus Christ our Lord. And that's why we're pleading with unbelievers to receive this reconciling love of God that is in Jesus Christ, by which alone we might be saved. And I think that comes through here with Van Til. He's not trying for academic sophistication. He's trying to lay bare what sin does to someone. It leaves them totally divorced from God, hopeless and helpless. And in our apologetical reasoning with unbelievers, this urgency, this clarity, this sincerity has to lead. And Carlton, I think you've pointed us in that direction.
Well, as we pray that the Spirit would impel us to delight and flee to the regenerating influence of the Spirit and the light of Christ, as the light of his world, it is good to diagnose unbelieving thought for what it is. And one of the steps that Van Til makes here is not only does unbelieving thought abide a correlative deity, but it also holds to the normalcy of the human mind. I find this to be very important, that we sometimes think that human beings just think, you know, that things are just the way they are. And until somebody does something overtly wicked, they're not really engaging in sin. They begin from a position of neutrality. But he says, no, one of the marks of the fallen heart is that it assumes the normalcy of the mind of man.
Yes.
To put it in the passive voice that we see from corporations and things like that, mistakes may be made. mistakes have been made, you know, but those are not a result of sin. They're merely and always a result of carelessness or finitude, or perhaps we're thwarted by the field of the currently unknown. But one thing that is not acknowledged is the impact of sin on man's investigation of the world. So from the normalcy of the human mind, I'm building to a question here. Van Til says the fallen mind also sets before itself the ideal of comprehensive knowledge, right? That if God is not absolute, maybe I can be. And my mind is at a minimum on the same playing field as God's, and it's a matter of time before I catch up to him. Maybe an infinite amount of time, but still amount of time. Okay, so here's my question. The ideal of absolutely comprehensive knowledge, which Van Til gets into on page 65, the assumption of the normalcy of the human mind and the ultimacy of the mind of man at a minimum on par with God. Is there anything most basic to these dimensions of non-Christian thought, or are these non-Christian thought, these aspects that he's identifying, are they mutually implied in one another?
Here's my thought, Carlton. I think that Van Til would insist on an organic relation of co-implication on these points.
Yeah.
I think he would say that there's one of the features of sin is it's a kind of comprehensive integrating reality that mirrors or mimics the comprehensive integrated character of life before the fall. Sin infects and invades all of those wonderful relations of co-implication and organism that characterize the pre-fall situation, so that after the fall, the mind of man presumed as normal has at least postulates the ideal of comprehensive knowledge. Now, let me make a comment on that. I think people misunderstand Van Til on this. I don't think, apart from some idealists in Van Til's day, that people would say that comprehensive knowledge is attainable by man. Not even Hegel would say it's attainable by man, because Hegel says when the concrete universal dawns, you're going to lose individual consciousness altogether. Bonson used to joke, when the consummation of the concrete universal happens with Hegel, we're not even going to know it, right? But I don't think Van Til believes there are a lot of people sitting down saying, hey, I can attain, by some kind of implication and linear inference, Bosenkat, comprehensive knowledge. I think what Van Til's saying is that the abnormal character of the sinful mind is to presume such is the case in order to operate at all.
That's so well said. Can you say that one more time?
Yeah, that the function of the fallen mind is not to claim comprehensive knowledge, but in its normal mode of operation is to presume that comprehensive knowledge exists or is possessed in order to function at all. Just to proceed as though it's in place without even giving a rational justification for it. Why? Because the normal situation is to be dependent upon the one who knows all things, ordains all things, and interprets all things infallibly. And so if that's the normal situation, to proceed in terms of dependence on the one who knows all things, the quote-unquote normal fallen mind is to proceed as though such is the case in negation of God, in rebellion against God, even if that justification is not given in some kind of rational system.
Okay, that's really helpful. I want to read a quote because Van Til, in the middle of page 65, gets into kind of the experiential presuppositions of the non-Christian with respect to absolute knowledge. Okay, and here's the quote. He says, "We can readily see from this," that is the impact of sin, "that the non-theistic mind must set for itself the ideal of absolutely comprehensive knowledge as long as it has not become fully conscious of the implications of its own thought." So he says that the non-Christian sets before itself the ideal of comprehensive knowledge as long as it's operating inconsistently. However, it will maintain that it is unnecessary for man to have any comprehensive universal in order to live. As long as non-theistic thought still thinks it necessary for man to have an absolute universal, it naturally has to set for itself the task of finding this universal, inasmuch as God has been put out of the picture. Then, when it appears impossible for man ever to find a universal, inasmuch as the particulars of the time are by definition always ahead of any time-generated universal, man says that he does not need any absolute universal anyway, except as a limiting concept. Okay, that's one of those paragraphs the reader probably would need to read like 7 times, 10 times, 20 times to really grasp what he's saying. Yeah. But what I think Van Til is doing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is he's kind of walking through a series of fallen, sinful, rationalist presuppositions that the non-Christian posits in order to get the knowing enterprise off the ground.
Yes.
Is that fair to say at the beginning?
I believe so.
Okay, he's trying to diagnose. How does the non-Christian think about the world apart from God? Mm-hmm. Well, to begin, the non-Christian functionally assumes that there has to be unity to the world.
Yes.
That whatever we explore in terms of the world's individual things, somehow those things have to be brought together. Yes. We have to have a unified experience of the world so as not to think we're just living in la-la land that's constantly changing all around us, mm-hmm. as we ourselves are, so that nothing stable can be said. Mm-hmm. So at a minimum, he functionally assumes a unified understanding of the world. Well, he's saying that assumes that there is a kind of comprehensive universal. Mm-hmm. Even if the non-Christian acknowledges, look, I don't have it yet.
Yes.
It's somewhere out there and it's not provided by God. But then he says, then when it appears impossible ever for man to find a universal, insofar as the particulars are always ahead of any time-generated universal. Okay, pause right there. He's saying whatever the universal unifying principle is, it has to be located within this time-space world because it can't be God.
Exactly.
Therefore, the newness of everything that man is discovering always seems to outpace the unifying principle because finite man's always experiencing new things. So right. We can't ever get to this final end game that unifies everything. So what does man do then? He begins to despair that there is any unifying principle. And this is how Van Til concludes. Then he says he does not need any absolute universal anyway, except as a limiting concept. Okay, what does that mean? Here's my best shot at it, and I want you to clean it up. Man posits that hypothetically, or he must assume that there is one in order to practically operate in this world, even though he can never find it, nor does he believe that it actually exists. Man must assume that there is a unifying dimension to the world just to live practically in the world. We're moving from the idealist sort of quest for the universal to the pragmatist's functional assumption of a universal, even though it's not actually something that he will find, nor even seeks to find. Yes. So how would you map out this like non-Christian attempt to pursue or at least assume a universal account of knowledge apart from God in some other way? I mean, he seems to be walking through this experience of frustration, trying to trace it where it leads.
Yeah, there, Carlton, there are so many ways to try to go about saying this. I think you've already nailed it. So I'm not going to say anything corrective, only maybe supplemental. I think Van Til might be talking about the way that people move from lower forms of sophistication to higher forms of philosophical sophistication. And at the lowest form, you have to posit the idea that the world is rational and that laws and facts cohere and that knowledge is incremental and developmental and has some kind of ultimate end. You have to do that if you want to operate rationally in the world, which all image bearers want to do because they're made in the image and likeness of God. But as you start to reflect on the development of culture and philosophy and art and so on, all of the individual particulars are running so far ahead of your universal principle that it's like it's lost. You're like, where did that end? Where did that rational principle of unity go? Because we've got so many new particulars. And I think it's there that the more sophisticated minds start trying to posit a system like Hegel did, where all developmental reality is moving in terms of these triadic patterns of a thesis, its negation, and a synthesis, with the postulate that in the end, there can be ultimate unity among the particulars. And I think in the most sophisticated idealists of Van Til's day, they were doing just that. But I think Van Til's saying something like this, that unbelievers of any sort have to assume something similar to what Hegel and the idealists were assuming in order to have any confidence that they can pursue science, that they can operate meaningfully in the world. And when they're doing that, they're borrowing Christian capital, as it were.
Yeah. Well, on that point, it's almost like it's like someone trying to build an airplane while they're in the air. Almost, you know, so I tend to think of it that way. The Christian capital, stolen capital, borrowed capital, whatever metaphor you want to use is an apt one, because they're already on an airplane, but they brought with them a bunch of airplane parts and they're building it as they go. So this might not be a proper metaphor, but in mathematics, you have this notion of an asymptote, which you can just imagine, like, from where you're standing, Carlton, or sitting, Carlton, to your door, if you moved halfway towards your door, and then again, you moved halfway toward your door, and again, you moved halfway toward your door, you'll never get to your door. Mm-hmm. But you're always adding further distance to your pathway. So if you graphed that, it's the curve that continues to approach a point or a line on the graph, but it never ever gets there.
Zeno's paradox. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I wonder in this sense, there's some sort of limiting concept. Limiting concepts can be that's a phrase that can be used a couple different ways. I'm not so sure about the total semantic range of the way Van Til uses them all the time, or if he's using it here in a more traditional philosophical idealist.
Yeah. I think epistemological system. I think he is using it in the traditional way.
So you have to have that concept. Great as if. You have to have that concept, I think, in order to make sense of the pursuit of knowledge. But if you don't have an absolute to begin with, a comprehensive knowledge, then you're ending up with a world in which there are brute facts. So you come to learn something that has never been interpreted before. Mm-hmm. So we believe the world is entirely known and understood by God. And so everything that every real fact, I'm not talking about the way that the news talks about facts now. You have your facts, I have my facts, I have different facts than you. No, a fact is a fact is a fact. We can interpret them differently. But God has an understanding and a concept, and he has an interpretation. Our job as creatures is to reinterpret the world according to God's interpretation. And to understand everything in light of God's knowledge of the world that he's already created, sustains, and pre-interpreted. But for the non-Christian, every new thing they encounter is completely uninterpreted. So you end up with the particular first. And then you have to incorporate it into your so-called absolute, which is no absolute by definition, because you're moving it on the fly. It's a changing mm-hmm. absolute, a developing mm-hmm. absolute. So there you get that Hegelian notion. I don't think that's exactly necessarily everything that Van Til is talking about, but those are some things that his commentary you bring up in my mind. Just that constantly pretending as if you're standing on solid ground, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you're constantly encountering new things and then building the solid ground that's supposedly already under you.
Yeah, that's a really to use good your airplane illustration. That second one is very good. You're pretending to stand on solid ground, but you're grabbing new materials along the way, trying to force it under you at every point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very good. I mean, I just remember, you know, Kant. I can't believe we're trying to make a practical point using Kant, but you know, Kant's great as if. If we're going to live ethically, we got to live as if there is a God who rewards righteous deeds and punishes evil deeds, right? Because the world of theoretical reason, the world of scientific observation doesn't give us any ethics. So we have to live as if, but we can't really know this God. He doesn't actually speak into time and space, but we have to live as if he exists. We have to live as if the self exists, even though we have no rational basis for believing it. And I think a lot of people live their lives that way, right? They just say, well, I'm going to live as if this is true, but they're making modifications on the fly at every point. Yeah. And as sort of coming from Van Til's perspective, we would want to take those people and say, hey, listen, you know that your great as if is constantly evolving. Mm. And doesn't that undermine the entire enterprise? Mm. I mean, how can you have any unified experience if every new experience you have is suddenly adjusting everything that you once thought you knew? Mm-hmm. Let me show you the Christian way where, yes, you learn new things. Yes, you have to modify pre-existing beliefs if they're proven to be false. But the whole enterprise is arranged within the framework of the absolute God who has made himself known. And who sovereignly upholds every aspect of the world. And actually, your job is not to build your own platform, but to acknowledge how God has arranged the world.
Yeah, and you know, Carlton, you brought this up, and Camden alluded to it. But in Christian theism, in the Reformed faith, we have an absolute who is wholly determinative and interpretive of all things in advance of the historical process.
Mm-hmm.
For Hegel, the absolute idealist, and for the pragmatist, every idea is intrinsically indeterminate, intrinsically developmental. There is no stability. And the only difference between them is that Hegel assures us, hey, at the end of the process, it's all going to work out. Now, you won't know about it when it does because you'll be assimilated in the absolute and lose your particular identity, but it can be harmonized at the end. The pragmatist says, no, all there is the indeterminate adaptation of ideas to reality to make a better world. It's utopian at root. And Vent Hill is saying to both of them, all of that ground is equally sinking sand, because the only solid foundation is one that begins with one who is absolutely determinate, comprehensively self and world interpretive, and reveals himself as such and gives us a basis for hope, for rationality, for progress, and ultimately for communion with himself.
Yeah, amen, brother. Mm-hmm. Amen. The pre-interpretation is already there. I don't know why it's making me think of this, but you remember there's a Diamond Rio country song called Already Gone. I'm already gone. You know, like it's already there. This is like the worst. We can edit that out.
Oh, we should leave it. Oh, man.
Oh,
blast.
Yeah, I just looked at the lyrics. Okay. I'm already gone. Never thought I'd cross over the line, but it's way too late. Your love is just too strong, and I'm already gone.
I remember that good. One.
Yeah, I, you're stretching me on that one.
Blast from the past. I walked in. I was down deer hunting, bow hunting, and I stopped off for dinner one night at the local Texas Roadhouse. And it was like a blast from the past because they had, well, it was great. I mean, and lots of nice folks. And on one TV, they had some sports games on, but on most all the other TVs and on the stereo, it was 90s, like mid-90s CMT videos, you know? And it was
Man. Wow. Way down yonder on the Chattahoochee. Yes.
That's right, man.
Alan Jackson was on there. All sorts of wild stuff. Yeah. Brooks and Dunn, you name it. All that good stuff. Whatever. Wasn't a huge country fan then. I mean, I got my mega dose of it. But
Well, you know what? One last observation before we conclude. I just want this impressed on the hearts and minds of the listeners. Van Til talks about the need for distinguishing a threefold consciousness.
Yeah.
Adamic consciousness before the fall, the sinner's consciousness unredeemed after the fall, unbelieving consciousness, and the regenerate consciousness of those who are joined to the promised and now ascended Messiah. And he points out that these are categorically distinct, and that neither the fallen nor redeemed consciousness is consistent until the consummation. And he says this, he says it makes for a very complex situation when believers are not perfectly consistent and unbelievers are not perfectly consistent. But he ends the statement, ends that section by saying it's only if we keep these categories before us that we can make any sense of the concrete situation in which there are unbelievers and believers who are not yet brought to an estate of glory, but have concrete presuppositional commitments, concrete religious commitments that cannot in this age be reconciled due to sin on the one side and redemption on the other. So that he's not saying, gee, what a complex situation. How can we address this? He's saying we can address the problem of unbelief only to the extent that we hold to a properly defined fourfold estate of innocency, sin and misery, grace and glory. And I find that remarkably useful.
Very useful, Lane. If I could make one final point as well, under the unregenerate consciousness, we started out our discussion today talking about the impact of sin and its devastating effects for man's knowledge of the world. I think it's worth stating that Van Til acknowledges that unbelievers are inconsistent with their most basic hostile fallen presuppositions, and that is owed not to some residual capacity to reason rightly about the world, but it's owing to God's restraining hand of common grace. And he says, since we could not cut ourselves off from God metaphysically, there remain, and here I'm adding a little bit, I think there's an incomplete sentence there right on page 66, there remain what he calls rudera, or scintillae of the knowledge of God and of the universe in man. And rudera and scintillae translate to remnants and sparks. Remnants and sparks. Now, I actually did some background work on this. Like, where does Van Til get that, rudera or scintilla? Sure. Usually when he quotes the Latin, he's borrowing it from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he's borrowing it from Abraham Kuyper. In the Encyclopedia of Sacred Theology, Kuyper says this: in consequence of common grace, there remain the rudera or sparks of light in the sinner, and the curse upon nature has not yet come in such measure, but that invisible things are clearly seen because understood by the things that are made. Romans 1:20. Okay, slight concern here arose in my mind when I read this, because it seems to say, Van Til seems to be saying, that sparks of light or the remnants of the knowledge of God are still in fallen man's consciousness because of common grace. And when I found that quote in Kuyper, I was like, ooh, Kuyper is attributing to common grace this knowledge of God. Thankfully, in an unpublished manuscript by Van Til, he says this: hence, we conclude that the rudera, the remnants, are not remnants of the image of God in the narrower sense. They are aspects of the image of God in the wider sense.
There we go.
They amply account for the best that the human spirit outside of redemptive revelation has produced. So I know we're rushing through this, but like, it's very important when thinking about the unregenerate consciousness and the inconsistency of the unbeliever. When we see the unbeliever stating things that resonate with a Christian worldview, when we see the unbeliever thinking, quote unquote, rightly about the world, Are we saying, which is all owing to God's common grace, are we saying, hey, that common grace actually grants to the non-believer a true knowledge of God and the world, even though it's not complete? No, we do not say that. We do not say that. We say that a true knowledge of God is already stamped upon the human heart. And what common grace does is facilitate a kind of twisted expression of that knowledge of God in the fruitful, quote unquote, things that the non-Christian does in the world. Anyway, I just wanted to make that point that the knowledge of God is stamped on the heart. Properly speaking, the rudera and sparks of light are there in the heart of the sinner, and they come forth in a, albeit twisted way, on account of God's common grace. And then, of course, when Christ brings somebody into union with himself, the Christian himself is inconsistent in the working out of a Christian epistemology, but on a fundamentally different foundation. We're inconsistent because of the remnants of sin, but we're on our way in a true acknowledgement of the revelation of God in man and in the world.
Very helpful, brother.
Yeah. Thank you. Very, very good. This brings us here toward the end, or at least there's a lot more to discuss, but we'll pick it up next time, hopefully on page 67, 68, on the next section of Van Til's book, The Defense of the Faith. This is always exciting to talk about this with you, brothers, and we hope people might have questions or comments. You can send those in online at reformedforum.org/contact. We have a form there. It's easy enough to use. Or you can send us an email, mail@reformedforum.org, and it'll find the right place and person. There's so many things online. You can find a whole host of courses, upcoming events, publications, blog posts, other podcasts. It's all available on the website, reformedforum.org. But I would encourage you, if you're going to do one thing, take a look at our online courses, particularly our Fellowship in Reformed Apologetics, soon to be complete. It is recorded and completed in terms of what has been recorded. We're just finalizing some things before we publish everything. That's all online at reformedforum.org and on YouTube. So if you're on YouTube and you're following us there, please subscribe, do what you can, help us out with the algorithm by liking videos that you actually watch and like, and tell your friends about them. It's really hard to get any easier than just sending a YouTube clip, at least nowadays if you're connected to the internet. That's one way you can help us out a tremendous amount. We really appreciate that. But I do want to take a moment to thank everyone for listening and for watching. And of course, we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.